Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all, Canada's most irreverent talk show here at The Andrew Lawton Show on True North on this Thursday, March 28th, the day before Good Friday. And this is obviously a very solemn and somber occasion for Christians, a category in which I count myself a very proud member. But it is followed by a very celebratory and joyous day on the weekend. So if Easter is your jam, as the kids say these days, I actually don't know if the kids say that. Actually, I don't know if anyone says that, but at some point, I believe people used to say that. Then I wish you a very happy and blessed Easter this weekend. But alternatively, if you are in the Jewish tradition, it's not quite Passover time. So I will wish you a blessed Passover in, I think it's about a month from now. No, about three or four weeks. Anyway. Nevertheless, my calendar on my computer always reminds me of holidays that I like don't even know exist necessarily. Like it's apparently Tartan Day on April 6th, and it's in my calendar. And then Vimy Ridge Day, I knew about that one. I probably always forget what day it is, but that's on April 9th. And then, as we all know, Louis Riel Day, it was trying to get me to celebrate a few weeks back, and I wasn't having any of that. But we will never. Easter is a lot more important than Louis Riel Day, I will tell you, despite what Louis Riel maybe thought of himself as being some sort of prophetic figure. But now I'm offending all the Manitobans again. Okay, I got to stop doing that. Welcome to the show. We're going to be talking a little bit later on with our good friend Franco Terrazano on the eve of the great tax hike day, April 1st. Not just the carbon tax is going up, but the alcohol tax is going up. Member of Parliament's salaries are going up. April 1st is proving to be a bit of a momentous day, and not one that is treating taxpayers all that well. I also want to speak a little bit more about the Online Harms Act. Now, this is Bill C-63. This is the piece of legislation the Liberal governments have done that they purport to be a panacea for all that ails internet users. They want to, with just one big, broad brush, deal with child sexual exploitation, revenge porn, the terrorist content that we know is pervasive on the internet, and also online hate. One of these things is not like the other. The online hate provisions are incredibly dangerous. They're also doing criminal code reforms, which I believe are incredibly dangerous. And one of those has become front and center in a little bit of damage control slash political spin being done by the Toronto Star. The Toronto Star ran an op-ed from Sabria Devetti, who is a longtime media figure in Canada. She says, "Have you heard the one about Justin Trudeau attacking your free speech online? Trust me, that's just rage farming." Now, Sabria Devetti, I have known for many years. I have always gotten along with her. Even today, I asked her, because I said I was going to be doing this on the show today. I asked her if she wanted to come on. She said she was tied up in meetings, so couldn't join. I've got a good relationship with her. We were colleagues back when I worked in traditional media at Global. I would occasionally guest host for her on 640 Toronto. So I get along with Sabria, even though I disagree with her on a lot of things. This is not, in my view, however, a case of disagreeing with her opinion. This is a case of her being flat out wrong, in my view, but we'll get to that in a moment. Let's talk about that Toronto Star piece. Let's put that up again, Sean. "Have you heard the one about Justin Trudeau attacking your free speech online? Trust me, that's just rage farming," by Sabria Devetti, contributor. Okay, now what's unique about Sabria Devetti? She's a lawyer, she's a former talk radio host, but you scroll way down in the bottom of the article there, you get the key part here. Sabria Devetti is a senior advisor to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and was a former columnist for the Toronto Star. She is a Trudeau staffer. She left her career. She was working, I believe, at McGill University in one of their digital media centers, but she left that to go and work for Justin Trudeau. Okay, that's fine. I don't know why. That's like boarding the Titanic when you're about three quarters over the Atlantic. It's already hit the iceberg, but hasn't gone down yet. And you're like, well, that the food on that ship looks great, so let me get on board. But nevertheless, Sabria decided she wanted to go on to Justin Trudeau's team. She wanted to be a part of the Prime Minister's office. She is a senior advisor. Nothing wrong with that. Our system relies on people advising the government. But she is also now the spin doctor of this piece of legislation, which I find very, very strange. Political staffers are typically not the ones putting their bylines on columns. Political staffers are not typically the ones doing interviews to sell or champion legislation. I mean, my thinking, and I mean no disrespect to Supriya on this, was there no Liberal member of parliament that wanted to put their name on a defense of the Online Harms Act in the Toronto Star? Was the justice minister who is selling this bill perhaps unavailable or uninterested in doing this? But she talks about criticism of this bill being rage farming. Rage farming, that's the term she uses. Rage farming, which is basically just trying to gin up hatred online. She talks about this as though there are no legitimate critiques or criticisms of the bill. Because she's appealing to authority here. She's defending the bill. When we talk about the hate speech stuff, it prohibits speech which is fomenting or likely to foment detestation or vilification. The language comes from a Supreme Court decision, but that is not the defense that she and other defenders of this bill seem to think, because the Supreme Court left a very confusing decision there that doesn't actually give much in the way of clarity when you want to see how a human rights tribunal is going to adapt that decision to individual expressions of speech. But let's get into where I believe she is factually wrong. Again, I am not a lawyer. I cover legal issues. I interview a lot of lawyers, but I am not a lawyer. So I was fully prepared to admit that I might have been misreading something or I might have been getting something wrong. The more feedback has come from other sources, the more I am convinced that is not, in fact, the case. Because Supriya said this on Twitter. After one user said the bill threatens life in jail over nasty comments to politicians, Devetti responded by saying, "That's not what the bill does. A max of life imprisonment for hate has to accompany an underlying act that is also punishable by max life imprisonment. So if you attempted to murder someone on the basis of their race, religion, sexual orientation, etc." So what is at stake here is the amendment to the criminal code that the Online Harms Act puts forward, which says if a criminal offense is motivated by hate, that criminal offense could carry... Oh, you gave it away, Sean. You gave it away. No, take that away. Yeah, okay. I was going to like just bombard people with that at the end to make the point dramatically. It's a little less dramatic now, but we'll work on it. The bill says that, you know, if you add an offense, if you add hate motivation to an offense, it carries a life sentence. Now, Supriya was very clear that no, this will only apply to things that already have a life sentence. Now, she also criticized Andrew Coyne, making the same argument I've made on this on the show. He made it in a Globe and Mail column. Supriya said this about Andrew Coyne's contributions to the matter. Probably unhelpful to the discourse when our national newspaper lets columnists just make all sorts of stuff up about the bill. Coyne is demonstrably wrong here. So that is, again, her saying that if you make the claim that this bill could theoretically put a life sentence on someone who vandalizes the side of a mosque or the side of a synagogue, again, wrong, I'm not defending the act, that could carry a life sentence. Now, we've talked about this on the show. Judges are unlikely to give a life sentence to someone who does that, but the point is that the criminal code will, if this bill passes, make that possible. Critics have said, including me. That is my reading of the bill. Supriya says in her point, that is just wrong. Now is time, Sean, for the dramatic reveal. Let's consult with the legislation. Everyone who commits an offense under this act refers to the criminal code, or any other act of parliament, if the commission of the offense is motivated by hatred based on race, national or ethnic origin, language, color, religion, sex, age, mental or physical disability, sexual orientation or gender identity or expression, is guilty of an indictable offense and liable to imprisonment for life. If you commit an offense that carries theoretically a sentence of less than 2 years or not even a jail sentence, this bill says that will be, if motivated by hate, an indictable offense, which means you're talking about a prison term of 2 years or more, up to life in prison. That is what the legislation says. Now, I very politely pointed this out to Supriya. And again, I loaded my tweet up with caveats because I said, I am not a lawyer here. I could be wrong. If I'm wrong, show me. And I just said, please provide a citation. This was her response to me. She says, it's a more than fair question. The answer is that you and others are reading the legislation in complete isolation from the binding principles of common law that apply to sentencing and bind sentencing judges, not to mention Section 718 of the Criminal Code, which she shared a screenshot to, which basically says sentences must be proportionate. But no one is talking here about proportionality. We're talking about, does this bill fundamentally alter the maximum permissible sentence based on motivation? The legislation says yes. Supriya is saying no. She says that we are actually not allowing this to change anything that doesn't already have a life sentence. Now, that raises the obvious question, which I put to her because we were having a very civil exchange on X. And I said, okay, well, what's the point of it then? What's the point? This was her response. She says here, the honest answer is that it explicitly denounces hateful conduct. The standalone hate crime provision will make it much easier for law enforcement to track hate crimes across jurisdictions because right now, when it's only considered an aggravating factor at sentencing, it's very inefficient. I've never heard this argument championed before. It may or may not be correct. I don't know. But it doesn't fundamentally change that this law is being misrepresented by the Prime Minister. Well, again, I don't know if the PMO sent her out to write that op-ed, but by someone who works for the PMO and has written an op-ed trying to defend this bill. It's just fundamentally wrong. Now, other people who are far more learned, who are themselves lawyers, have weighed in and mercifully have agreed with the plain text reading that I had of the bill here. Howard Anglin wrote that Andrew Coyne was right. It's exactly what it does. And he just says, your response is trust judges. Yeah, and that's basically the PMO's response here. They're just saying, well, judges aren't going to give a life sentence for something minor. The point is that this will override the current provisions on this and will give them that option. I want to welcome into the show Christine Van Guyen, who is the litigation director of the Canadian Constitution Foundation. We've talked about some of these concerns on the show in the past. Always good to talk to you, Christine. All right, who's right here, Supriya or yours truly?
You're right, Andrew, and yes. So are all of the lawyers who are on Twitter with Supriya, I guess, explaining the law to lawyers. As far as I know, is she a lawyer? I don't know
if she's a member of the bar. I believe she was a lawyer at some point, okay. Or at least went to law school. I don't know for sure, though.
Okay, so I take that back. But I have something that I think will entertain you. Which is, I mean, I read this morning and was quite irritated. I wrote to the Toronto Star saying that if they're going to publish Supriya, who is a government mouthpiece, I mean, she's...
Yeah, literally. I don't even mean that in the way that we often talk about some left-wing columnists. Like, she's literally a PMO staffer.
She works for the Prime Minister. If they're going to publish that, then they should and allow the critics of this bill, who are careful and thoughtful in their criticism, then they should allow a rebuttal. And they've agreed, and they're running my rebuttal today. I've written one, and all credit to the Star for agreeing to run a rebuttal to Supriya's piece. So I'm excited that they're going to run it, but I'm a little worried that her meltdown will continue, and I will now be part of the meltdown. But I mean, I think someone needs to set the record straight that criticism of this bill is not rage farming. It is not bad faith. I think the government would do well to remember that freedom of expression in Canada and is a fundamental right. It is actually a precursor to peace and security and democracy. It is not a threat to our society. It's what makes our society possible. And the government should, instead of attacking critics of the bill, which include academics from across the political spectrum, the more than 6,000 people who have written to their members of parliament through the Canadian Constitution Foundation's online platform expressing their concerns with the bill, the Canadian icons like Margaret Atwood who have expressed concerns with this piece of legislation, as well as lawyers and academics who actually will be the ones engaged with applying this law. All of that criticism is something that the government should be listening to, not attacking and saying we're rage farming. I mean, no farming is necessary. People are angry and it kind of springs up naturally. Like, I don't need any fertilizer for this.
Sean, can you put up tweet four for a second again? This is the common law, the principles of common law one from Supriya. I want to get your take on this, Christine, because one of the points that Supriya raises here, she said, no, it's the other one. The principles of common law one. She says here, no, we'll keep going. We'll get there eventually. There we go. The honest answer is, sorry, go back to the other one. This is the great thing about live media. So she says here that basically that you can't look at the legislation as a standal or a separate from principles of common law is basically the thing. We don't have the tweet, but that's fine. You can't look at it separate from common law principles. And as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, because as I've caveated up the wazoo, I'm not a lawyer, but statute kind of overrides common law, does it not?
So I do think that Supriya has a point here in saying that judges will apply principles of proportionality that are already in the criminal code. Section 718.1 of the criminal code deals with sentencing, and there's proportionality sentences. There's also common law application of sentencing that you wouldn't have a disproportionate sentence. But I think that that's true. That the legislation does make the things that we're all saying possible. So it certainly would be possible that if you peg on a hate as the motivation to any of these offenses, that the government, the crown, the prosecution can argue for life. They're unlikely to get it. It will relate to the underlying offense. But it's certainly possible for them to argue it. And I think that that's a really important point, because what we're not talking, the risk isn't just in whether a court will sentence someone who engages in, for example, mischief motivated by hate or vandalism motivated by hate. It seems unlikely that the courts would give them life imprisonment. But what this legislation does is it allows the Crown to add the hate motivation onto any offense, including a minor offense like mischief or vandalism. And that gives the prosecution the power to threaten far, far, far higher penalties for minor offenses that they can then use to pressure a defendant to plead out, including in cases where a defendant shouldn't plead out because perhaps they are poorly represented, the hate threshold isn't met. This is most likely actually to happen to people who are marginalized in our society, who are less able to afford a judge. So it's actually going to end up hurting the most marginalized people in society. And look, I'm not saying that vandalism or mischief, if it's motivated by hatred. And I think some classic examples are the desecration of cemeteries or spray painting offensive symbols onto religious places of worship. I mean, those things, the people who commit those offenses should have an intervention, and a criminal prosecution could be a part of that. But allowing the Crown, the prosecution, to hold this threat of huge penalties by tying the prosecution to a hate offense, really, that's the on-the-ground application of this law. That's really dangerous. Someone on Twitter also pointed out to me that by adding a hate offense, if the person is an immigrant, has immigrants, some type of permanent residency, it could be used against them in a deportation proceeding, even if the charges are not made out. But by having a minor offense moved into a more serious offense category. So there's all kinds of spillover effects that Supriya is frankly ignoring, that good faith critics of this piece of legislation are pointing out. So I'm glad the star's running my rebuttal, because I have a lot to say about it.
No, so am I. And I think your point about it's easy to focus on judges. And again, an argument that hinges on trust judges is not, in my view, the most compelling one. But
even if you do, Supriya's article is trust me. Trust.
Well, yeah, trust government. Yeah, trust the PMO. That's the. But you are right too. I mean, when you talk about that categorization of offenses, it isn't just about the possibility of a life sentence. It's also about taking things that would normally be dispatched with a fine and putting them into indictable offense territory.
Yeah, I mean, and it's the threat. It's a threat, even if the person, perhaps they have not made out the threshold for hate speech, that they have the threat now to plead out because there's this thing hanging over their head that there's a much more dangerous offense that they could be convicted of that comes with a much more serious penalty. So, I mean, Supriya's article makes a huge number. A lot of these are just straw man arguments, right? Like, throughout mm-hmm. her article, one of the big things that she focuses on is this criticism a lot of us have of peace bonds. And she says that, peace bonds, the critics of the peace bond provision is that members of the public, with the consent of the Attorney General, can seek a peace bond to put restraints on people for future speech. So if there's reasonable grounds to believe that a person will commit engage in hate speech in the future, a court can order all kinds of restraints on speech, including things related to access to the internet. They can even impose house arrest or electronic monitoring, like an ankle bracelet. And people have raised a lot of concerns about this for obvious reasons. And Supriya says that critics of the peace bonds are misguided, that we're rage farming because peace bonds are not a novel.
She blames the right wing online ecosystem first and foremost. I think that's me. I believe I'm part of that because she mentions people invoke Minority Report, and I literally did that like 3 days ago. So I think I might be obliquely or directly in the crosshairs on this one.
I mean, the reality is that no serious critic of this bill is suggesting that the Liberal government invented peace bonds in this piece of legislation. We know that they exist. The critics, including us, are saying that the problem is a peace bond for future speech, because that in itself is inherently speculative. And in her article, she compares these peace bonds for future hate speech with peace bonds for shocking or terrorism. And I just don't think that this helps her argument at all, because terrorism, courts can be a lot more certain about the risks involved. It's really obvious if someone has bought materials to buy a bomb or build a bomb. And there's also a lot more certainty about what terrorism looks like. Whereas with hate speech, the court needs to speculate and get into the mind of a person about what they may say in the future and whether it meets the threshold for hate speech. And that threshold, which comes from a Supreme Court decision in Wutkot, is a really squishy, speculative, and subjective definition. So hate is defined as detestation and vilification. And I mean, frankly, these are synonyms for hate. So hate is defined by reference to itself. It's not especially helpful. And I think when you've empowered the public to seek peace bonds against fellow citizens using a definition they're unlikely to understand, you really are creating a chill on speech. And this is what the critics of the bill are saying. We are not saying that a peace bond is a new creation by Justin Trudeau. We're saying this is a bad application of a peace bond, and there are serious risks associated with it.
We're going to attempt to do a tweet again. Maybe we should just avoid it here. But this is a Supriya tweet. Starts with, the honest answer is that it explicitly denounces. So this is in response to me saying, if your claim is that this will only apply to things that already have a life sentence, what's the point of it? She says that it will make it easier for law enforcement to track hate crimes across jurisdictions because it's inefficient when it's only considered an aggravating factor. I'm having trouble following the argument here, but I was wondering if you could weigh in on this at all.
I have no idea what she's talking about. Okay. I think the goal that the government has is they want more prosecutions for hate offenses, and this is the way to achieve it. So right now it is treated as an aggravating factor, but it also, there also are standalone hate offenses already in the criminal code, right? There's provisions about public incitement of hatred and willfully promoting hatred. And they're not, especially on the public incitement, they're not, there have not been a lot of prosecutions because the threshold is really high, and it's supposed to be high. I mean, we're talking about criminalizing speech here, which is something that's fundamental to our functioning as a democracy. So I don't really, I think what she, what the government wants is more prosecutions for hate offenses. This is their way of attempting it, but I don't understand her, her justification here. I just don't know what she's referring to.
Okay, no, that helps me. I thought I was the moron for not being able to figure it out. But let me just ask you about the problems with this, because the government, you know, they always do the, oh yes, well, we'll talk about this in committee. But for the most part, they aren't really admitting that they've got anything wrong here. They've had years. This was first put forward, or a version of it, in 2021, shortly before the election. They've been promising it basically since that election. They were first promising it within the first 100 days. It's now 4 years, well, 3 years after it was first tabled. So do you think this is sloppy, or do you think everything in there is very deliberate and that's exactly what they wanted?
I think that there is zero consideration for how this will actually be applied on the ground. And I think, Andrew, you should interview some criminal defense lawyers to talk about their concerns with the law, mm-hmm. because they're the ones who are going to actually be representing people who are now going to be facing this, you know, sledgehammer from prosecutors to increase the severity or the potential range of sentences for otherwise minor offenses. Supriya says this is something that we don't need to worry about. Perhaps the government hadn't thought about how this law would be applied on the ground, because they're, you know, bureaucrats, including in justice, in the Justice Department, they're not the ones who actually work and engage with, you know, people who get charged with crimes. So they might not really understand how this could play out if you give the prosecutors this massive tool.
Yeah, very well said. Look forward to your response op-ed in the Toronto Star, not written by someone from the Prime Minister's office, blissfully. Christine Van Gyn, Litigation Director at the Canadian Constitution Foundation. Always a pleasure. Have a great Easter weekend.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Christine. Well, it is on April 1st, the big, great tax hike day. The carbon tax revolt, as I've been calling it, has been underway now for several, I mean, really years, but in particular, several weeks. We have 7 of 10 premiers who have joined the call, with Manitoba Premier Wob Kanew kind of just, you know, figuring out where the wind is blowing before he says anything publicly. But I think we can say his silence is speaking volumes here. But we also had a few premiers testifying before committee this week. Premier Scott Moe of Saskatchewan had a great interjection that I wanted to share with you here.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This is one of the policies, and they are stacking, that is making life more unaffordable for not only Saskatchewan residents, but all Canadians as a whole. It's making industries less competitive. Those are industries that employ people in my community and quite likely in yours as well. And it is really showing no measurable impact when it comes to reducing emissions. And I would just point to the inflationary aspect of the carbon tax specifically today. And that was when the latest consumer price index came out. Saskatchewan today is at 1.7%, down under the 2% projected target that the Bank of Canada had hit, one full point lower than the Canadian average. And Statistics Canada had said specifically that was due to a decision that the Saskatchewan government made to remove the carbon tax from home heating. And so you can imagine what would happen to our CPI nationwide if we were to pause, first of all, and then remove the consumer carbon tax on Canadians.
That was, again, a very dispassionate, fact-based approach to this. Scott Moe has taken a very heavy hand. He had the benefit of having a tool in his toolbox that other provinces didn't have, in that he could just stop remitting the carbon tax on home heating, on gas, to the government. Danielle Smith, the Premier of Alberta, also appeared before committee. Very similar, took a fact-based approach to this.
I'm here on behalf of Albertans and Canadians who are struggling with severe financial pressures. They're increasingly desperate because they're facing a cost of living crisis not seen in decades. Over the last 2 years, inflation and high interest rates have driven up prices on everything from food to gas to housing, things that Albertans rely on every single day. Families are being forced to make tough choices just to put food on the table. Businesses are having to make sacrifices to keep the lights on. Social services are under intense strain as more and more people reach out for help, many for the first time in their lives. Albertans and all Canadians need common sense, compassion, and responsible government to prevail. That's why I'm urging you today to heed the calls of Canadians across the country and suspend the increase in the carbon tax on April 1st. The carbon tax has contributed to and worsened Canadian stress and financial pain. Despite the federal government's claims that Canadians benefit from rebates, the carbon tax on a net basis will cost Albertans more than $900 this year if the tax is implemented. The federal government's own parliamentary budget officer has also said that the cost to each Albertan will more than triple in the next 6 years to a staggering expense of $2,700 net by 2030-2031. This isn't just reckless, it's immoral and it's inhumane. And the added pressure will ruin countless lives, futures, and dreams. It's a weight that Canadians can't bear.
A weight that Canadians can't bear. Truer words have not been spoken by anyone at the federal level. But as we have talked about time and time again, Justin Trudeau has put the blame back on the premier, saying, well, you guys didn't come up with any ideas. Now, incidentally, some tried to, but the government said, no, that's not a high enough tax. It's not a high enough tax. No, that doesn't count. Go back to the drawing board. Blaine Higgs in New Brunswick, he was also a premier who testified and was able to get a hearing from him. Now, what was interesting in the case of Blaine Higgs, and Scott Moe faced this as well, is that the Liberal MPs really didn't want them to be able to speak. These are premiers. Whatever you think of them, they are elected heads of government in their respective provinces. And my goodness, Liberal MPs did not like that Canadians were getting a chance to hear from them. This was what happened when Blaine Higgs was giving his testimony.
So my plea here is across party lines to say, let's think bigger. Let's look at Canada as a solution to world environmental impact and changes
in reduction. Point of order, Chair.
As opposed to us being exactly focused on our internal affordability and the costs every day of living.
I apologize, Premier Higgs. I just have a point of order. Mr. Long, please make it brief.
Thank you, Chair. I'm confused on relevance.
This is an opening statement, Mr. Long. Please show respect for the Premier. You may have disagreements with us, but please show respect for the Premier of your province.
Sure, Chair.
It's an opening statement. Let him finish this.
But again, I'm just wondering the relevance, and I'm also wondering, Chair, if you can explain again which of the votable items referred to in the committee contains the Canada carbon rebate. I'm confused. You able to let us know that?
Explained that yesterday, Mr. Long. Mr. Premier Higgs, go ahead. That's not a point of order. Mr. Higgs, go ahead,
sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That was rather interesting. It's irrelevant to hear from the Premier of New Brunswick about what people in his province are dealing with. And again, similar criticisms of Danielle Smith and Scott Moe being there. But even if the federal government is not listening, that doesn't mean Canadians aren't. Pierre Poilievre was in Edmonton yesterday. Again, you think Alberta equals conservative, but that's not really the case in Edmonton. He still had over 3,000 people out. We had one of our reporters, Isaac Lamoureux, there. And Danielle Smith was one of those 3,000. She actually took the stage as well. And I don't have the video of it, but I believe got her own Axe the Tax t-shirt that she sported while she was on stage with Pierre Poilievre. But let's talk about really what's all happening here, specifically on Monday. Franco Terrazano, Federal Director for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, joins us once again. April 1st is a big day, not a good one for taxpayers, though, is it, Franco? What's happening that day, first off? Because it's hard to keep track of it all.
Well, April Fool's Day, hey? And like so many other times, taxpayers are the punchline in Ottawa. Okay, you've got carbon tax going up, alcohol taxes going up, and member of parliament pay going up. So you're going to pay higher prices at the pumps. You're going to pay higher prices when you go to the bar and restaurant. And your tax bill is going up to fund even more bloated salaries of our members of parliament. So a bad day to be a taxpayer, let me tell you.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask a little bit about the momentum here. I know there are some rallies, well, not some, I mean, quite a large number of rallies and these mini convoys that are being planned for Monday. Pierre Poilievre himself has been bringing out thousands to his Axe the Tax, Spike the Hike events and whatnot. I know your colleague, Chris Sims, I think actually right now or in like 30 minutes is doing a press conference in Alberta. So there is a groundswell here. It's just not translating into action at the one level of government that can do something about this.
Well, and that's at their own peril, right? If Liberal MPs and NDP MPs want to keep voting to raise people's carbon taxes, that's at their own peril. Because here's the thing. Canadians are absolutely united against these carbon tax hikes. Canadians are sick and tired of the federal government not only making our lives more expensive, but making the necessities of our lives more expensive. Canada's a big place. You know, people have to fuel up their car to get to work. Well, the carbon tax makes that more expensive. Canada... it's a cold place. People have to heat their homes. Well, the carbon tax makes that more expensive. And one more point, right? We all know that the grocery prices are high. Well, let's think about that for a second. Because the carbon tax will cost Canadian farmers $1 billion by 2030. So the carbon tax makes it more expensive for farmers to grow food. It makes it more expensive for truckers to deliver the food. And it's also making it more expensive for Canadians to afford food. Right? So Canadians absolutely united against this carbon tax, not only Canadians, but also provincial politicians of all political stripes. So the only ones who are tone deaf and late to the party are Trudeau, his ministers, his Liberal MPs, and also NDP MPs.
Let me ask you here, Franco, about the two bits of information that the government has been giving to sell the tax that I feel are confusing to Canadians, and I'm hoping you have the numbers on this. Number one, most Canadians are better off with the tax than without it. Now, that on the surface sounds ridiculous, but the government touts this rebate and says, no, most Canadians are getting more in the rebate than they're paying. So that's claim one. Claim two, that all of the experts agree the carbon tax is not a significant driver of inflation. It's just one, you know, itsy bitsy, tiny, teeny little fraction of inflation and not a significant driver. Go.
All right. I'm getting the football and I'm going for a run, ladies and gentlemen. So on the rebates, wrong, magic math. Okay. Now, I think I heard the prime minister say something along the lines that the premiers are spreading misinformation. Well, there is a bunch of misinformation, but that is coming from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, his cabinet ministers, and his Liberal MPs. Because the Parliamentary Budget Officer, the government's own independent nonpartisan budget watchdog, shows that the carbon tax will cost the average Canadian family up to $911 more a year than what they get back in rebates. Hundreds of dollars more a year than what they get back in rebates. But let's just set that data aside for a second, okay? Let's just think about it logically. They charge a carbon tax, then they charge their sales tax on top of the carbon tax. That tax on tax alone costs Canadians about $500 million this year. And then it costs the government about $200 million to hire the bureaucrats to administer the carbon tax. So there is no way that a government can impose a carbon tax, charge its sales tax on top of the carbon tax, skim a bunch of money off the top to pay for a bunch of bureaucrats, and somehow make the vast majority of Canadians better off with rebates. That is impossible. But Andrew, only a couple months ago, by his own actions, Trudeau proved that the carbon tax does make life more expensive. Remember, he was surrounded by his Atlantic caucus, and he announced relief by taking the carbon tax off of furnace oil. Now, why would he do that? Because he knows that the carbon tax does make life more expensive. Now, Andrew, that's the rebate shenanigans busted. Let's talk about this letter from The Economist. Well, you hear economists talk about efficiency all the time. Well, Andrew, it doesn't sound that efficient to me to make it more expensive for Canadian parents to fuel up their cars to get their kids to soccer practice with a tax that won't solve a global issue. It doesn't sound efficient to me to make it more expensive for Canadian seniors to stay warm during the winter months with a tax that won't solve a global issue. It doesn't sound very efficient to me to make it more expensive for a Canadian single mom to put food on the table with a tax that won't solve a global issue. And not only that, you know who Trudeau should actually be listening to? The people he's supposed to represent, Canadians. And the vast majority of Canadians do not support his carbon tax hikes. So he should listen to Canadians, and at the very least, he should cancel the carbon tax hike.
All right. April 1st, are you going to be out in the streets as well on Monday?
Well, we're going to be so busy. All we're doing is talking carbon tax, alcohol tax, MP pay raise. You know, you talked about Chris Sims doing a press conference today. I did a press conference in Ottawa today, and I know a lot of my colleagues all across Canada are going to continue to bang the drum with press conferences of their own.
All right. Well, we look forward to that as well. Have a great long weekend and enjoy the little bit more affordability you get between now and Monday, I guess. That's the have a little tax-free rum springer this weekend. Franco Terrazano, always good to talk to you, sir. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Andrew. Happy Easter.
All right. Thank you very much. If you are looking to do some Easter shopping, may I remind you, I have a new book coming out in exactly 2 months, 2 months to the day. It comes out on May 28th. It is called Pierre Poilievre, A Political Life, a biography that I hope is, well, it's certainly not exhaustive in the sense that he's still got some life left in him, but maybe we'll have to do a sequel in a few years' time. But that is available for pre-order. And thanks to all of you who have done your part to shoot it up to number one on Amazon the day and two that we announced it. And certainly I hope it'll be another number one bestseller when it's released. But if you want to get your bid in early, that is available for pre-order now. And you will be here. Speaking of beating the drum, I'll be beating the drum about that one for like 3 weeks when it comes out. So please forgive me. That is it for today. We will talk to you all on Tuesday with more of Canada's Most Irreverent Talk Show. Have a blessed and happy Easter, everyone. Thank you. God bless. And good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.